Hi, I'm John Spurney, a musician living in New York City.
Let me just get you warmed up by asking, you know, from what you've read and studied of Beatles history, how would you describe the band's vibe in early January when they're gathering to record this material? You know, again, from an historian standpoint, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think at the point when the Beatles got together to start work on what became the Let It Be project, and at that time was called Get Back, they were really probably at their nadir in terms of personal relations. The experience of making the White Album had been emotionally fraught, and Ringo had actually quit the band during the making of that record at one point. John's relationship with Yoko was causing problems with the other members of the band. The fact that she was in the studio all the time with them when historically the studio had been sort of their special enclave for just the four of them. And things were really bad, really at a bad point. And I think part of the impetus for the Get Back project was to try and get away from the drudgery of constant overdubs and big studio productions and spending hours and hours crafting a song into this big production, and to just get back to the joy of making music in the moment. And, you know, the overarching creative idea behind Get Back was no overdubs, you know, just one take of the band playing the song in the room, everybody singing live. And it's kind of ironic that ultimately what happened is, you know, they wound up giving the tapes to Phil Spector, who added, you know, reams and reams of these totally inappropriate overdubs with choirs and orchestras. And but the initial impulse, I think, was to try and get away from the bad place they were coming out of with the White Album and do something simpler and that would allow them to get back to their roots and kind of find the joy in music making again.
Let's talk about the overall listening experience. And I don't know at what point, you know, you crossed paths with this album. When you listen to it, and you can either talk about it then and now, how does it strike you as a collection of songs? How does it strike you that way?
You know, Let It Be is always kind of a disappointment to me. It's probably one of the Beatle albums I listen to the very, very least. It's certainly of the later records, it's the one I listen to the least. And although there are a couple good songs on it, you know, the fact that it was kind of cobbled together from a lot of pieces and is kind of a mishmash of a failed project, to me, is kind of readily apparent listening to it. You know, it's a very uncohesive record. You have these sort of stripped down acoustic numbers next to these heavily orchestrated schmaltzy numbers. And I mean, curiously, if you listen to, you know, the record was originally, when the record was entitled Get Back, it was mixed by Glyn Johns, who for all practical purposes was kind of the producer for the sessions. And his version of Get Back, which is available as a bootleg, it was actually released to radio stations. So it's pretty easy to find those tracks. His mixes are much more the sort of warts and all approach that I think the Beatles originally intended the project to express. So it's a much rougher record than the Let It Be record that Phil Spector did. But in a way, it's almost truer to the intention. And there are a couple songs on it that aren't on Let It Be. But I guess the ultimate expression of the Let It Be material is ultimately Let It Be Naked, which is the version Paul McCartney put together long, you know, 30 years after the fact or 40 years after the fact, you know, to try and put the material out the way it was originally intended. And there, at least, you know, the sort of the beauty of a song like Long and Winding Road, when it's just Paul playing piano and singing with the band backing him up, you can really appreciate, especially the ballads, I think, without the sort of schmaltzy stuff that Spector added. You know, at the time, Lennon was very thankful for the job that Spector had done. And I think Spector was given just an incredible mess, just, you know, reams and reams of tape with terrible takes and mistakes, and the fact that he was able to cobble together what he did is obviously a testament to his talent. Unfortunately, I personally think he aesthetically overstepped his bounds and tried to turn Let It Be into this kind of, you know, massive production that, you know, not only I don't think the material warranted it, but it was the exact opposite of the intention of the project. Mm-hmm. So Let It Be has always been kind of disappointing to me. And it's disappointing to me that people, I think most people think Let It Be was the Beatles' last record. But in fact, Abbey Road, which is one of my favorite Beatle records of all time, was recorded after Let It Be. And Let It Be was released after Abbey Road. But Abbey Road is actually the last work they did together. And that makes me really happy, because to me, Abbey Road is an incredibly positive statement and kind of a fitting way to end their career and, you know, begin to sort of foster their legacy.
And we'll talk about that shortly. But before we leave Let It Be, let me ask you to look at that track list. And, you know, if given what you just said, or in light of what you just said, if there are still, you know, some moments of appreciation for certain tracks that you'd like to talk about individually and just try to separate them. Like if you're going to talk about one, just lead with that track name and say a few things about it and then, you know, okay, stop and then move on to another track.
I mean, I'll tell you, you know, definitely when I was a kid listening to Let It Be, one of the things that struck me about it and one of the things I loved about it was the fact that they included the sort of chatter in between songs and, you know, the sort of like Lennon wit, the sort of witticisms of John Lennon that he would sort of toss off in between numbers. And you know, that was always something that I appreciated. And the first bootleg I ever bought, Beatles bootleg, was a kind of infamous bootleg called Sweet Apple Tracks, which is a collection of the sort of soundtrack from the film crews who filmed the rehearsals for Let It Be. And you know, those records are just full of these kind of Monty Python-esque, you know, almost skits that are kind of happening between the guys in the band as they rehearse the numbers that became Let It Be. And I always appreciated that. It gave me a deeper feeling for their personality and I loved that about the record, you know. And just when you put the record on, the first thing you hear is, you know, Lennon saying, "I dig a pygmy," and you know, and everybody laughing, and the, you know, "I want to thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we've passed the audition." You know, just those little sort of funny things. I loved that about it, and I loved the sort of intimacy of hearing the studio chatter. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, years later, I found out that basically they went through all the tapes and found the pieces of chatter that they liked the most, and then spliced them onto the numbers that were going to be on the record, you know, to make it seem as if they were off the cuff, you know. But that's still something that really struck me about that record that I liked.
So as a musician, though, what are there some intriguing moments or?
Yeah, I think, you know, I love the stuff that actually was recorded live, and specifically the stuff, the rooftop stuff, which if you see the movie, it's amazing to see the Get Back and the more rocking stuff, like I've Got a Feeling and I'm just looking at the list.
Don't Let Me Down.
Let Me Down.
Which was not on
and,
the
and I'll tell you, one thing that really strikes me and moves me about Let It Be is Billy Preston. And, you know, George Harrison brought Billy Preston in to play keyboards, because if they were going to be doing these songs with no overdubs, obviously they would need to have a keyboard player if they wanted any keyboards on the songs. And B, you know, I think quite skillfully, he realized that if there was somebody there playing with them who wasn't in the band, everybody in the band would behave themselves a little more and they wouldn't fall into the sort of emotional problems and arguments that had plagued them during the making of the White Album. So I think the inclusion of Billy Preston was brilliant on that level, but even more brilliant is his playing, you know, and the Fender Rhodes solo he plays on Get Back is just awesome, super funky, and not something you would expect to hear on a Beatles record, I think.
Any other songs you want to talk about before we leave this project?
Let's see. I'm looking at it, you know, not really, you know, it's not, it's weird. It's not, it's just not one of my favorite records. I don't listen to it that much, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Fair enough. Have you seen the film anytime?
I have seen the film. You know, I had a, there used to be a great store here in New York City that sold a lot of sort of bootleg, rock and roll DVDs. And so I had a copy of Let It Be, which someone stole from my apartment. But I really hope that they ultimately give that film a proper re-release, because if you're a Beatle fan, it's incredibly interesting to see. And especially if you're a musician, just kind of seeing the dynamic between them. And there are some scenes in that film that are just excruciating to watch. I mean, just the bad vibes are really captured on film. And I think they were attempting to document they're getting back to their roots, but what they really wound up documenting was their demise as a band, and maybe that's why they haven't actually released it, but it's certainly worth seeing.
Yeah. It struck me as this, tell me what you think about this notion. You know, the Beatles in many ways kind of created the blueprint for what being in a band could be about. You know, everything from the highest high to the lowest low to the personality squabbles to the women involved, and I'm wondering if, as a musician, if there's some sort of appreciation for, you know, what they did in this step. Maybe they didn't intend it that way, but they ended up stripping the veneer from, you know, the romance of being in a rock band that was somehow instructive to anybody else that wanted to get on this adventure as time went on.
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, when younger people sort of ask me, like, the Beatles, I don't get it. Why is it such a big deal? You know, you have to say that the entire paradigm of being a pop star to this day was basically created by the Beatles. So, you know, the whole notion of a pop star kind of asserting their artistic integrity and saying, you know, this next work of mine is a bold statement in a new direction, and maybe entering into a political element, certainly, you know, a non-specific political element, like, you know, peace and love. And, you know, now it's almost sort of a cliche, like, you know, the way a band will sort of change its look for each album. And, you know, this album is going to be sort of our broad political statement about brotherhood or, you know, goodwill or whatever. And then, you know, the Let It Be sort of portion of the paradigm is when that road becomes untenable. And so you then strip everything down and, you know, you show up in jeans and a T-shirt. And in a weird way, I think it was the progenitor of, like, the MTV Unplugged thing, you know, the sort of idea of taking a band that people only knew through these kind of very controlled electronic productions and allowing them just to perform in a very simple, stripped down way. And, you know, it's something that's now been emulated a million times, but I think it really does all, like most things in the world of pop stars, you know, it really all does filter back to the Beatles. And it's a shame that more people don't realize that.
So I know you were born after Beatlemania. What were you born, 68? Or?
I was born in 65.
65, okay. So a lot of this is you know, backtracking for you in the 70s and 80s when you were, you know, getting turned on to the Beatles. But and you've become such a student of it, I feel like it's a fair question. What else was going on with the Beatles between, say, February and August that you think is, you know, important or interesting about the Beatles 1969 story?
Wow. You know, I don't know if I can say much about the like their personal lives and stuff. Like, I really know more about just the work, you know what I mean?
Yeah, okay.
Like, I guess maybe and you probably know this better than I, like maybe that was when Harrison was having marital problems. You know, I don't really know. I can't really speak to that.
No, that's cool. I didn't know how detailed the study of their comings and goings went on. You know, and it was more of a it was the year that, you know, McCartney and Lennon both got married. Lennon, you know, notably did a lot of his peace work and started shaping sort of a post-Beatles.
Right, the Bed-In was that year, right?
Yeah, well, Give Peace a Chance came out. He was recording Cold Turkey,
right?
You know, some things.
Yeah, so I mean, my understanding is that he was sort of battling a heroin addiction. I don't know if that's post Abbey Road or not, but you know, I've heard that.
Yeah.
But again, you know, I can't. The only stuff I can sort of speak to really is the music.
Yeah, that's cool. All right. Well, then let's get back to that then. So. Let's talk about what you referenced as one of your favorites then, with Abbey Road, and you know, talk generally about it first, you know, how it comes across to you or how you experienced it. And then, you know, I'll ask you to pick apart some things that you like to point out to maybe, music fans.
Okay. You know, I think actually, and this is going into the depths of my childhood, but I'm pretty sure that Abbey Road was the first Beatles album I heard. And I, you know, I was 4 years old when Abbey Road came out. And I have a memory of a neighbor's brother who was a teenager playing it on a portable record player in his front yard. And I really remember specifically the song Come Together. So, you know, the record is kind of ingrained really deeply in my childhood. But I think, you know, my favorite Beatles record is Revolver, but Abbey Road is definitely my second favorite. And I think it's a little underrated. I think, you know, I think it's a much better record than Sgt. Pepper. And Sgt. Pepper obviously is the one that gets all the attention and the accolades. And to me, that has more to do with when Pepper was made than the music itself. You know, to me, I think Abbey Road holds up much better as an album. And you know, now that sadly the album format is dying or dead, you know, I wish people would check it out because Abbey Road is kind of the perfect example of what an album, you know, two sides of 20 minutes of music aside. You know, how that can be crafted into this incredibly moving experience. And you know, to me, the concept of sides is very important to Abbey Road. You know, and the first side is songs, kind of rock songs. And then the second side is basically a suite of interconnected songs. And that all kind of come together at the end. And I don't know, there's just a really beautiful feeling of unity about the record and wholeness, and it just really feels like it's all of a piece. And I can't really think of the songs on it as individual songs. I really think of Abbey Road as a thing. You know, it's like you don't think of the first movement of Beethoven's symphony as a thing unto itself. You know, it's part of a symphony. And Abbey Road to me is that way. It is everything in it is of a piece. And I love that about it, mm-hmm. You know, and I think it really, the concept just really holds up even today.
Well, let me ask you to say a few words about some of these, and we'll start with Come Together. It made an impression on you then. A lot of people talk about it as being a quite unusual song in many ways. Deconstruct it a little bit for us that will help
sure.
us.
Sure. Well, the fact that Come Together opens the record – you know, it's such an alluring song, and it just starts with that bass line. I mean, the bass playing, you know, as always, McCartney's bass playing is just incredible and faultless and so beautifully melodic, but grooving. But I think in Come Together particularly, you know, when the song starts, you just hear that boom, da doom, boom. You know, there's he glisses a lot between notes always, and it just makes the bass feel much more sort of human and sexy and it's fantastic. And Abbey Road was actually, you know, every Beatles record was made on the same mixing board. But except Abbey Road. Abbey Road was the first Beatles record that was made on a transistorized board as opposed to a tube board. And it sounds very different than their other records. It's the first record that was recorded entirely on 8-track. Most of their other albums were done on 4-track. And it just has a much, to me, it has a much warmer sound. It's also the only Beatles record that was mixed for stereo. The main mix, the mix that was intended for people to hear was the stereo mix. The other albums, stereo was sort of a novelty, so the mono mixes were the actual mix. So the stereo mixes that exist of the earlier records were usually done long after the records were made and without the Beatles present. But Abbey Road is the only Beatles record where the main mix that the Beatles were involved with is the stereo mix. And it's just a beautifully sounding record. You know, it's kind of, it's really warm and kind of dark. There's not a lot of high end on it. You know, these are all sort of esoteric things. But to me, part of my enjoyment of the record is just the sound of it, the way it was mm-hmm. recorded.
Come Together strikes me as such a nice interplay of their musicianship, you know. When I think about it, you know, I think of the bass and Ringo's drumming and Lennon's vocal and Harrison's guitar. I presume it's Harrison playing that lead lick. I'm not sure, but
It's beautiful. And you know, the thing that I love, it's such a great tape echo on Lennon's vocal. You know, the Beatles used this thing they called Steed, where it's kind of complicated, but they would send the vocal track out to another tape machine, and that would delay that track. So when it came back and was mixed with the original vocal, it sounded as if there was a slight echo to the vocal sound. But what they would do is they would send Lennon's vocal out to another tape machine to delay it, and then send that delayed signal into an echo chamber and then send that back to the board. So basically what you hear is an echo that is reverberating. And it's this very characteristic vocal sound on Beatle records. And it's really pronounced on Come Together, especially when he's going, shoot me. And it's terrible and kind of macabre, but what he's actually saying is shoot me. And there are other takes of the record where he's just sort of, I believe on the anthology, you can hear him. He just says, shoot me. You know, he's like yelling it every time. And, you know, given what happened, it's incredibly distressing. But I mean, when you hear him whispering it, it's such an alluring just that shoot. You know, and the way it echoes, it's just incredible. And to start the record with that, it really draws you in.
And Ringo on this record?
Ringo to me, I'm a big Ringo fan, and I think it's somewhat fashionable amongst musicians to claim that Ringo didn't have the chops or whatever, or wasn't fancy enough, and I wholeheartedly disagree. And I would say, just listen to the pattern he plays on Come Together. Like every time in that riff, it's like two hits on a flirt tom, a little flourish on the hi-hat, and then a triplet roll across the tom. So it's always like dun dun tick ticka booga ticka 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 boom boom ticka ticka booga ticka 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 ticka. And it's like as much a part of that riff as anything, is what McCartney's playing, as you know, as what Lennon is doing vocally. You know, all those things kind of coalesce together. And, you know, this is also, Abbey Road has the only recorded drum solo that Ringo Starr ever did. And Carry That Weight. And it's great. You know, it's perfectly appropriate for the song and great.
As a songwriter, I'm sure that you would probably have some interesting takes on Harrison's two tracks on this album. You want to tell me a little bit about what makes something?
Sure. I mean, this is the album where Harrison really comes into his own. And he always had a couple songs on every record. But on this record, his two songs are not only arguably the best songs on the record, but they're also arguably some of the best Beatles songs ever. that being Something and Here Comes the Sun. And, you know, Something is one of those songs that by the time I was a kid, it had thoroughly ingrained itself into sort of Muzak. And it was one of those songs that I probably heard 10,000 times in elevators as a kid before I ever knew it was a Beatles song, you know. But there's something so classic about the melody and the structure of it. And in fact, you know, Frank Sinatra called it his favorite Beatles song, although I think he incorrectly attributed it to McCartney or Lennon. But I mean, that's an incredible song. And then Here Comes the Sun, which is just another sort of beautiful, very positive, moving song that, you know, still to this day, when I hear it, I mean, just how basic that sentiment is, you know, it's been a long and lonely winter and, you know, just the whole notion of spring and rebirth and, you know, it sounds so corny, but when you listen to that record, I mean, you just really feel it. It's really legitimate and it's just beautiful. You know, another thing Harrison did on this record is he bought one of the first Moog synthesizers and, you know, brought it into the studio, you know, and this was when synthesizers were these huge hulking, you know, things with patch cords and hundreds of knobs and switches. And, you know, they really weren't designed for working musicians to use. They were kind of designed for academics, you know, who were teaching electronic music courses at universities. But Harrison bought one and brought it in for the sessions on Abbey Road. And it's incredible to me how tastefully it's used throughout the record, and especially given the sort of excess that the 70s and the 80s brought us with synthesizers everywhere and just the crazy overuse of electronics. You know, the fact that the Beatles had this kind of new, strange electronic instrument and just were able to exercise such incredibly tasteful restraint and just use it so masterfully, you know, it's just, to me, a testament to their greatness, you know. I mean, it's on, there's a beautiful little synth line on Maxwell's Silver Hammer, which supposedly McCartney played. You know, the early Moog synthesizers had a keyboard, but they also had a thing called a ribbon controller, which was something you would press down with your finger, and basically by moving your finger to the right, the pitch would go up, by moving your finger to the left, just one finger. As you held it down. So basically you would have to move your finger and stop at the appropriate note, and the tone would slide between the two notes. And McCartney plays this little counter melody during Maxwell's Silver Hammer, you know, and the story is that he did it in one take, basically just, you know, moving his finger up and down, this kind of somewhat complicated melody, counter melody. And when you listen, you know, it's kind of mixed back and you have to listen to hear it, but it's beautiful and, you know, just very satisfying.
And you're saying he played that on the Moog?
Yeah. Like, as far as I know, you know, Abbey Road is one of the very first records with a synthesizer on it. There's some synth on Strange Days by The Doors, and there's some synth on Bookends by Simon and Garfunkel. You know, it was still a relatively new and exotic instrument, but definitely Abbey Road is kind of the first use of it in an exceedingly musical and sort of orchestral way. You know, there's synth on Because, there's synth on Here Comes the Sun. There's even this great use of synthesizers of the time had what was called a white noise generator, which was an electronic circuit that basically could output all frequencies at the same time. So the same way if you combine all colors together, you get the color white. If you combine all frequencies together, you get what is called white noise, which is essentially just sounds like static. It kind of sounds like if you have a television set that isn't working and you're hearing static out of it. So they made great use of that in I Want You, She's So Heavy, in the end of the song, as the song repeats and repeats and repeats that incredibly sort of foreboding riff that goes on over and over and over. If you listen closely, they keep adding these layers of white noise and static that just kind of add to the general feeling of dread, you know, you get listening to that song.
Yeah, very good. And let's see. You don't have to say something about every song, but...
Okay. And, you know, one thing I would like to say about I Want You, She's So Heavy is I think people who have only heard the record on CD really kind of miss the sledgehammer effect of that song that it used to have on an LP on vinyl, because it was the last song on side one. So as that riff just repeats over and over and over, and you really get kind of lost in it. And then when it just ends so abruptly, you know, and when they were mixing it, Lennon just literally told the engineer, like, take a pair of scissors, and when I point to you, cut the tape, you know, and that's the end. And so, you know, it's this incredibly abrupt end. And when you were listening on vinyl, you know, that was the end of the side. So basically when it stopped, you know, there was silence, and it, you know, it was like the world came to an end. You know, you had to flip the record in order to hear Here Comes the Sun, you know, which was this kind of beautiful answer. You know, it was this kind of hopeful, soft, you know, got you back into a good place after this terrible journey that you take at the end of I Want You, She's So Heavy. Unfortunately, you know, when you listen to the record on a CD, I Want You, She's So Heavy ends, and, you know, there's maybe a second of silence, and then, you know, Here Comes the Sun begins. And to me, you really lose the intended effect, you know.
It is an interesting effect, because I can remember listening to that. I mean, it was a 7-minute, 47-second song. So psychologically, you're having this experience of sort of saying, gosh, this is going on. When's it going to end? When's it going to end? And then they deliver on the end, but they deliver it in such a way that is totally surprising for the time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the first time I heard it frightened me, you know, that ending. It literally was like the world came to an end. I mean, if you were really concentrating and listening, you were so lost in that repetition. And then to just kind of have it ripped out of your head in such an unnatural way, you know, it was really affecting. I love that song. And you know, that's another number that Billy Preston plays on. And his Hammond organ playing on that is incredible. As is, you know, McCartney does these great, I mean, I call them motorcycle sounds. He does these things on the bass where he basically does glisses high up on the neck, and you just hear this like, like you can hear him. Paperback Writer is kind of where they're the most obvious, that boom, 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 boom. But I mean, when you hear him on I Want You, She's So Heavy, he also does these great things where these like descending things where he's doing like 16th notes with his right hand and then just moving down the neck with his left hand. So you hear this kind of like, it's almost like a sound effect more than, you know, bass playing, and they just all combine. It's incredible.
Yeah. There's I guess there's always some controversy about musicianship on these songs. I'm looking at books as you're talking, and the first book I look at does not credit Preston on this particular one, but I'm going to check out a couple of others and see what they say.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I think Preston plays, I mean, look at the books, but I'm pretty sure Preston plays B3 on that number, and I'm pretty sure he plays the Rhodes, the electric piano on Come Together.
Yeah, I'll check it out. We don't have to debate it here, but it's I'm going to look into Lewison's book, because that'll probably
be, yeah, because that's the one. I mean, that's the Bible.
Yeah. So what about you know, it seems like we need to talk a little bit about this notion about creating a suite of songs out of fragments, and whether and how that was extraordinary for the time. What's your take on it as you absorb the music of the era?
You know, I think having the suite of songs was definitely a first, and you know, Pepper had sort of spawned more grandiose, you know, sort of progressive ideas about what an album could be. And, you know, people had already done, you know, the Moody Blues had done their sort of orchestral suite type records, and even, you know, somebody like Chad and Jeremy had made Of Cabbages and Kings with its Progress Suite, and you know, the Who. I don't know if Tommy had come out, but the Who were working on Tommy if it wasn't out already. The Pretty Things had made SF Sorrow, which was basically a rock opera in 1968. So, you know, the ideas of taking an album and treating it as sort of a suite of songs rather than a collection of singles to tap your toes to was definitely in the air, and the kind of experimental notion of seeing, you know, how you could expand the album format and really take advantage of it. That was definitely the aesthetic of the time, you know. But I think the side two of Abbey Road is just so flawlessly executed that it's aged a lot better than almost any of the records that I just mentioned, and you know, there's a beautiful kind of cogency to it and unity to it, and the way that sort of all the themes of the various snippets are kind of repeated at the end, you know, during Carry That Weight and the song The End, is just fantastic. And especially, you know, the thing I love is just the song The End and the fact that what I really think of as the last song on the last Beatles record, you know, the fact that it's just that simple lyric, you know, and in the end, the love you make is equal to the love you take. It, you know, to me, that's just such a perfect expression of the general aesthetic of everything the Beatles did, you know, and it just seems like a really fitting way to end their career. Now I should add, you then have the kind of postscript of Her Majesty, which deflates the bubble a little bit, which I actually think is a good thing. You know, it kind of lowers the level of pomposity of having this big, you know, orchestral work. But like a lot of Beatle things, like it was this very serendipitous coincidence where Her Majesty, when they actually recorded the suite, Her Majesty was slated to be in between Mean Mr. Mustard and Polythene Pam. And the reason Her Majesty begins with that big crashing orchestral chord is because that's actually the end of Mean Mr. Mustard. And so when they were listening back to the suite the first time they finally assembled it, when they spliced all the tapes together, I think everybody in the band agreed that Her Majesty just wasn't working in that spot. And it kind of slowed down, you know, the pace of the thing. So they asked the engineer to just cut it out. And of course they were working with tape, so that meant literally taking a pair of scissors and just snipping, or a razor blade, and, you know, snipping out the song, which the engineer dutifully did. And he spliced Me, Mr. Mustard and Polythene Pam together the way we hear them now. But the Beatles asked him, you know, he said, so what should I do with this tape of Her Majesty? Should I throw it out? And, you know, McCartney said, well, you know, we don't need it on the album, but do me a favor and just put it on the reel. So at least I'll have a copy of it. So the engineer took the finished copy of the album, put a few seconds of leader tape, which is tape you put at the end of a reel, which doesn't make any sound, basically so that the mastering engineer would know that's the end of the record, and then spliced on the little snippet of Her Majesty that the Beatles didn't want him to throw away. Now, when this tape went to the mastering engineer saw the leader, but then he heard this extra song and figured, oh, they must want some silence and then this song to be on the record. So when the Beatles got a test pressing of the record, you know, they thought the record was over when they heard the last chord of The End, and then there was silence, and then all of a sudden they heard Her Majesty, which none of them wanted or expected. But of course they all said, oh my God, that's fantastic, you know, just leave it. So nobody ever meant for it to be there, you know, but it was just sort of one of those happy accidents that the Beatles' career seems to be full of.
What a great story. Yeah. Well, John, I want to be sensitive to your tight schedule, so let me just do like a final call on any thoughts that were rumbling around about this record or this time in their history that you felt like you wanted to get down.
Okay. I mean, I will say it makes me really happy that Abbey Road, you know, that 69 started so terribly for the Beatles, And I think it ended on a much higher note. I can only speak in terms of their musical output, not in terms of their personal lives. But the Get Back / Let It Be project was really such a downer and such a bad time for them. And the fact that they were able to, by the end of the year, create this masterpiece in Abbey Road is really just a testament to their greatness. And I'm so glad they got it together, because it's a really beautiful record, and I love it.
Okay, fitting last chapter then.